Oh, the shape that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, so you might know him as the angry pundit who had a bust up with Jurgen Klopp over the weekend a few weeks ago. But to your surprise and my surprise, Roy Keane was actually a Premier League footballer once upon a time as well. Behind the grumpiness, behind the angry pundit who only cares about people giving it the big one on the pitch, Roy Keane actually played some football himself. Colin Bouygues and Kieran Bradley are on the line as usual to talk about this player that was Roy Keane. This is Team 33. Lads, welcome along.
Hey, Enda.
Oi, oi.
So I'm going to give first dibs to the Cork man in the room here, because once I mentioned that we were going to be talking about Roy Keane today, I barely had the message sent on WhatsApp before he was replying saying that he wanted to do this. So Colin, Roy Keane, tell me what you think.
Discuss. First of all, I played it cool when he sent that WhatsApp message in. I think if you look at the times, like, it's a few minutes before I reply, but I mean, obviously mentally I was like, yeah, absolutely, 100%, get me in on this. And then the other point to start with about Roy Keane is the point that you just made there, Enda, is that like a generation of people might actually not realize that he was a brilliant footballer and might just be limitlessly entertained by his punditry musings, if you want to call it that. But what a player. I mean, that's what I obviously want to discuss today is the player, because I think we're all done with the punditry side of it. Everyone knows about it, but you really do forget how great he was. And also, I was just looking back at some of his highlights there in preparation for this, and he was just such, I don't know what Kieran thinks, he was just such a beautifully simple player. There was just no fat in his play. It's like a brilliant writer where there was no, every word served the purpose. And for Roy, it was like every pass was totally crisp. And Matt Holland actually said that, and it's a very specific compliment, his ex-Republic of Ireland teammate, said that he's the best player I've ever seen to pass the ball 15 yards in front of him, ahead of him. But I knew instantly, I knew exactly what he meant. And, you know, I think everyone knows what he means, is that he rarely passed the backwards and his passing was very purposeful and to the feet or in front of the player or just behind the player, whatever served the purpose, he did it. And it all stems back from what Brian Clough said to him at Nottingham Forest, was that you can control the ball and you can pass it and you can run and do all those three things, which is what Roy Keane mentioned in the roadshow with us last year. And he just did that for his entire career. And lo and behold, he's one of the best players to play in the Premier League. And obviously, as a Cork man, you're immensely proud, regardless of his discretions.
Before we go any further and before I take you in on this, Kieran, I do want to dispel the fact that there has been a lot of revisionism in terms of Roy Keane and in terms of his style of play. And a lot of people just see him as a guy who went around kicking people and an enforcer on the pitch who essentially give it the big one, as he likes to say a lot of the time. But he was a fantastic footballer in his time. Like, he had the fundamentals down to an absolute T. And he demanded respect from everyone on the pitch. He wasn't just a commander on the pitch. He was very much a very stylish footballer in the best of his times. And I suppose injury kind of scuppered that at the end of his career. Kieran, before I get you on, we are talking about Roy Keane here for a specific reason. I'm going to be talking about to Owen O'Callaghan about his book, Keane, The Origins. Anybody who's watching us on YouTube will be able to see me holding up the fantastic cover of Keane. And it basically covers his career before he was the Roy Keane that we all know. It covers his time at Rockmount, his time at Cove, and his career building up to the point where he signs for Manchester United and becomes the Roy Keane that we now know. It's a really brilliant book, so I'm really looking forward to talking about Owen O'Callaghan a little bit later on. Kieran, your thoughts on Roy Keane, your memories of Roy Keane?
Oh, he was absolutely brilliant footballer. I'd tally a lot with what Colm said there. And it's interesting that you mentioned the Brian Clough three kind of instructions, because he was very clear to say during that roadshow that it might sound like they are the basics of football, but a lot of professional footballers can not do all three. They can do one or two, but all three is actually a fairly easy thing. And it's interesting because it reminded me of something that Teddy Sheringham said last week. I'm just dropping clanging these names out all over the place. But he was saying how it was all about, you know, win the ball, pass the ball, look after your mate. That was Clough's philosophy, and Neville said quite soon after that wouldn't work now. But in terms of a general basis for football, it's certainly a good educational point, and tallies with, I suppose, Roy Keane's early career as well. He was a brilliant footballer. He was a superb personality, an unyielding presence in both the United and maybe to a lesser extent the Forest dressing room, because he was a little bit younger. But as you say, like his passing was underrated. I think people have almost gone full circle with it now, and it's, you know, it's a little bit revisionist. But he was a really complete midfielder. You don't get to the heights that he did in that time with that team without having a little bit more than being this kind of clogger, this breaker-upper of play. So we all know the best of him. We've often seen the worst of him, but he's a phenomenal footballer, which Ireland were lucky to have.
Unlike the normal Team 33s, I am going to put a bit of a structure to this conversation. So I'm going to put Roy Keane pre-injury, so young Roy Keane when he signed for Manchester United, Roy Keane post-injury, post-treble, and then Roy Keane the pundit. So, Kieran, I'll let you go again. Roy Keane pre-1999, pre the United treble, pre his first cruciate ligament injury. Unbelievable pace for a player his size, really strong, really demanding in the air as well, which was such a surprise to everybody. But he really... I don't want to say he transformed United, but he was very much seen as the next Brian Robson, and he really didn't he didn't shudder in that sort of estimation. He kind of grew into that title.
Yeah, it's easy to underestimate how much of a totemic figure that Brian Robson was for United, because obviously United were not, in relative terms, not as successful in the 80s as they were in the 90s and the early 2000s. But Robson was at the heart of absolutely everything. He had his injury problems himself and missed several international campaigns as a result. But these were enormous shoes to fill. And it was actually Robson himself, I think he mentioned himself with us, but he said that he basically said, look, this guy's a player. He's basically the complete package. So to get that recommendation from Robson and that kind of anointment was enormous for Keane. As you say, the early part of his career was, it's interesting because you probably see this with a lot of players where they might lose or dull certain aspects of their physical capacity as they go through their career, but they replace it with mental side of things like reading the game or, you know, resilience or whatever it might be. But they coalesced perfectly around the time of 99, once he'd, you know, recovered from that injury that he suffered at Leeds. But the early Keane was amazing. And when he was twinned up with Paul Ince as well, it was just an enormously strong basis for midfield. And then obviously Paul Scholes comes through and adds that little bit of technical guile and a little bit more pace as well. But Keane was the foundation stone on which United's success was built, for absolute certain.
Do you remember him in his Forest days, Colin?
No, not at all. But I do look back at them on YouTube, and he was just so active and lively, and he was a box-to-box midfielder. He wasn't a complete midfielder. I actually don't think he was a complete midfielder. I think there were far better footballers than him, but he was the absolute best at what he was good at, and there's no one to touch him in that regard in the three foundations that we've already discussed. But with Forest, he was just... I suppose he was, it wasn't a headless chicken, because he ran with purpose, but he never stood still, and he was up and down. And there's actually a lot of footage on YouTube of Keane skinning players on the wing for Forest, that he would just knock the ball past them and run onto it. And that tallies with Keane's youth career in Cork, where he actually started off as a striker because he was so small, but he was quite skillful for that level, and he was very fast, as we've already discussed. And for Cove Ramblers, he played in the right wing a lot. So he had tremendous pace. And then when he went to Manchester United, I think he said he was a bit intimidated almost at the step up in standard. And I think it was Brian Robson who said to him that you know, Kieran Tierney discussed that relationship. But I think what the other thing as well, he was emphasizing to Keane was that you need to do more if you're going to be a success long term at United. And I think Keane took that on board, and he probably tailored his running style a bit to get on the ball more and dictate play more. And I think he took all that advice onto him, and he absolutely maximized the talent that he had. But he's very enjoyable to watch on YouTube from his Nottingham Forest days. And you can see why Blackburn Rovers and United had such a fight for his services in the summer of 1993.
Well, that's certainly something that comes out in the book, is that even though he wasn't exactly a demanding figure in the midfield or in the dressing room, what Clough really loved about him was that he did exactly what he asked him to do. And he was very much just up and down the pitch, energy, getting on the ball, winning duels, all that kind of stuff that you wouldn't expect from a 19-year-old playing for Nottingham Forest, coming through the academy, playing his first game in Anfield, then marking Paul Gascoigne. Some of those duels are really well documented in the book by Eoin O'Callaghan that we'll be speaking about later on. But Keane does go on to captain Man United in probably one of, if not the greatest United team of all time, is definitely in the Premier League era anyway. How big a figure was he in that 99 treble team? Because that's full of, we always hear about the class of 92, Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, Nicky Butt, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't hear too much about Roy Keane except for the semi-final against Juve. Apart from that, how big a figure was he on the pitch?
Well, he was as influential in the 1998-99 season as Eric Cantona was in 1995-96 when Cantona returned from his suspension. And when Keane returned from his year-long layoff, you know, people were concerned that he wasn't going to be the same player, especially because he worked hard and played hard very much so in the 90s, Keane. And he certainly wasn't an angel off the pitch, and he enjoyed himself. And when he came back, it was probably what the skinhead version of Roy, when I think that was the year after the treble, when he shaved his head and kept that for a few years after it. So he still had a bit of hair for 98-99 in it. But it stemmed into his... he just meant business more. And I think that when he came back after the year out, he probably wasn't as chummy with the players as he had been when he wasn't captain, when Eric Cantona was captain. Kind of, not direct parallels, but I know that Noel Gallagher talked about how he separated himself from the rest of the band after they had that fight at Whiskey A Go-Go when they just started off, and he was never as tight with them afterwards, and just became the absolute out-and-out leader and separated himself a bit from them socially. And that translated into their best success. I'm not saying Keane fell out with anyone at United, but he seemed to separate himself a bit more from his teammates after the injury. And in 1998-99, he was the absolute driving force behind the treble-winning side. I know he didn't play in the Champions League final, but he got them there. And I know he barely played in the FA Cup final against Newcastle because he went off injured so early, but he dragged them to the finals, the final weeks of that campaign, just like he dragged Ireland to the 2002 World Cup without playing. So he brought, he set up the party and he didn't attend. And that's Keane in a nutshell.
I would say, first of all, thanks for Colin Bowie's greatest hits there with a bit of Keller and a bit of Keane. That was lovely. It was very interesting, I thought, what Gary Neville was saying with regard to 99 and the European Cup final when Keane wasn't there, because Gerald put it to him, what's the crap with the central field? How did that affect you? And he made the point, and it was interesting the way he was saying it, because you could almost visualise it from Gary Neville's perspective. He said the balance was completely off. So they shifted Beckham inside to accommodate Blomqvist, I think it was. And basically everything was just the patterns that are in, kind of drummed into you over a period of just muscle memory over thousands of hours of football, which is not there. So aside even from the personality and obviously the technical ability and the performances, the side was so well curated at that point and it was so finely balanced that taking out an individual of Keane's quality in the middle of the park just completely threw things off. Now, it's my personal opinion that I think that the omission of Keane had more of an impact on the performance that day than the omission of Scholes. So he was amazing that season. I mean, obviously the Turin moment really stands out, but he had cemented himself as an absolutely key component for United that season, and it was reflected by his teammates in his absence.
Yeah, and Colin mentioned Noel Gallagher there. I do want to tip my hat to getting an Oasis mention in, because it wouldn't be P33 without Colin Boog mentioning Noel Gallagher. I also do want to give him plaudits for his Lee Sharp shout a couple of weeks ago, or last week. Lee Sharp actually plays a role. Well, he doesn't really play a role, but he's mentioned in the Keane book. The breakthrough season that Keane had at Nottingham Forest, he came second in the PFA Young Player of the Year, only to who, Colin?
The big man.
Lee Sharp.
Yeah. Too right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Remember the celebration with the flag? That is that the Sharpie Shuffle? Is that what it's
No, the Sharpie Shuffle is the Macarena.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But that's an amazing celebration. It's often underrated as well.
The Lee Sharp is 40% celebration.
Well, if you ask Seamus Coleman, I mean, I don't know if Seamus Coleman would have appreciated Lee Sharp celebrations no more than Roy Keane.
He'll do it again. Appreciated.
Yeah. Do it again, go on, do it again. That's one of the, it's the best part of the season so far. Like, whatever about there being a crazy amount of goals every couple of weeks, it's just like Seamus Coleman gone and done now. How is he acting like a bit of a hard man, or a classic Donegal man, as I like to say? But Roy Keane and his relationship with Alex Ferguson, discuss. I think that's like Pandora's box or something. I have a theory that Roy Keane and Alex Ferguson didn't get on at the end of their career because Roy Keane was transforming into Alex Ferguson, and they were the exact same type of figure, demanded respect, knew, respected hierarchy within the club, because Roy Keane came under Clough, who was very much, you are under me if you're a player and I'm the manager. Alex Ferguson was the same, always received a higher paycheck than all of his players, because he wanted to be the main man. He's the centre of it. It was because of him that this team was doing so well. And I think Roy Keane was a little bit piffed by that.
The Roy Keane-Alex Ferguson relationship epitomises the ruthlessness of Ferguson, because for 12 of the 12 and a half years, Roy Keane was extremely useful, nearly indispensable to Ferguson. And those final few months, when he had the almighty fallout with Carlos Queiroz in the pre-season of 2005 in Portugal. And even before that, there was inklings that Keane and Queiroz didn't get on. And Ferguson saw Queiroz as truly bringing United into the 21st century, a half a decade into it, that they could really compete on all fronts. And so Ferguson was leaning towards Queiroz and his sensibilities. And maybe he saw Keane as not part of the old school, but so immovable in his ideals, and they're so similar as characters, Ferguson and Keane, from what we view as on the outside. Of course, we don't know what happened behind the scenes, but that's the perception that we have. And there's only enough room for one of them when one of those two isn't as good as they once were. And obviously for Ferguson, his biggest strength was constantly adapting to the new generation of players, which is why he lasted 27 years at United alone and had a much longer managerial career. Whereas obviously, with each passing year for Keane, with the hip injury and the knee injuries and everything that goes with it, that he was becoming less and less dominant in games. And Ferguson probably had that building up for a while, was that, you know, we could probably get rid of this guy pretty soon. It's just endlessly fascinating, that relationship, isn't it, Ferguson and Keane? Because they're just so similar, and they brought each other so much success, and yet they don't speak now. And do you know who that reminds me of?
Oh, here we go.
The Pet Shop Boys. Yeah.
Blur.
Yeah, I just coming off the back of Colin's there. Like, they're obviously, look, I mean, it's been said relentlessly that they're so similar. And I think that's particularly the sad aspect now. Obviously, it came to a head when we were chatting to them at the roadshow, but they're obviously so obstinate, the pair of them, still, that both of them, I think, somewhere, just given that as you get a little later in life, kind of not aggression, but sort of arguments and the like become quite debilitating. Like, it takes a lot of your energy to kind of keep these grudges up. Lord knows they try. But I think deep down, a couple of them would like to probably have some kind of working relationship, because I just don't think it's actually that that healthy. However, Colm's right insofar as I think it's easy to forget that Keane was 34 when it came up to November 2005. So there's been talk for probably a year or two before that as to United are going to have to look to replace him in some sense, or at least blood someone in for the last couple of years of his career so that they can take the mantle up. Now, it wasn't until and even when Michael Carrick signed in summer 2006, there wasn't a sense that United had replaced him. And there was almost a sense that they couldn't, because he was such an enormous presence, not only personally, but on the pitch as well. So I think their relationship is fascinating. But I think that Ferguson, as Colm has said, just recognised the writing on the wall. And if not, like, planned it, which I don't think he did, then I certainly think he took advantage of, he kind of laid the rope there for Keane to do the business with.
Who'd won in a fight, Roy Keane or Carlos Queiroz?
Keane.
Seconded.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's a fairly obvious one.
Basically a difference.
Oh, yeah. Listen, age, you know, Queiroz could have a little bit of a wily fox about him. You know, he might be able to outthink Keane, be full-on aggression. Although there is actually a story in Owen O'Callaghan's book that we're going to be talking about later on about Keane absolutely flooring one of his teammates during his fast course. And they said that if he had to put himself to boxing, he would have been a great boxer as well, because by the time the guy had seen his two punches, he was already on the floor. So, you know, there might have been a boxer inside Keane as well. Post-career Keane, the old school pundit, the pundit that everyone loves to get sound bites out of and doesn't really delve too deep tactically into the game. Where do we stand on that? Do we think that he is actually, do we think this persona that he has now is the real Roy Keane, or where do we think he's at?
I think his timing throughout his whole career in football, on and off the pitch, with the exception of his management side, has just been perfect. He played in the perfect era for his style of play. I don't think he'd be anywhere near as effective nowadays, because a lot of his best attributes would be stamped out of the game. And in the punditry sense, without any intention at all on his part, he's fully taking advantage of the social media world that we live in now, where punditry is moving more towards sensationalism and drama, away from hardcore analysis. And you saw that with Patrice Evra. Evra's now just as entertaining as Keane in a different way, and possibly more so. And he's only just starting his Sky Sports contract, as he alluded to when Manchester United were hammered by Tottenham Hotspur recently. And Keane has a kind of a more of an assassin approach than the emotional Evra. But people love it. People tune in. I mean, as soon as we heard that Klopp and Keane had a few words, I think it was Kieran himself who took care of it for the site, and the numbers just flew up, because we know, and I mean,
old baby,
we kind of, you know, we're almost sighing at times because we're like, oh, another Keane piece, but we know how well it does. And whereas you're not going to get any particularly great insight tactically from Keane, it's box office stuff. And I do wonder, that do people even want the tactics from Keane? I would like it. I would like to hear what he actually has to say, but I don't know how much he does have to say about football beyond the emotional, character-driven side of it, and how men should be men and how you should get stuck in as much as you can. And he doesn't really care much for the modern player. He appreciates their talent, but doesn't like their off-the-pitch stuff. But, I mean, by all accounts, Keane, when he was in his coaching courses coming to the end of his playing career, he was every bit the modern coach at that time in the mid-2000s, and his fellow coaches were extremely impressed with him. And you'd forget that he actually had a brilliant start to his managerial career with Sunderland. He took over in August 2006 when I think they were bottom of the championship, when Niall Quinn started as the caretaker manager that season. And he brought them up, was it automatically, I think he brought them up to the Premier League, and they stayed in the Premier League pretty comfortably in his first season there. And then it went wrong when he started spending money on Pascal Chimbonde and El Hadj Diouf, and he got the wrong players in with the wrong attitudes. I think he got Steve Malbranck as well from Spurs. It was just players that didn't really want to be there.
Yeah.
And then it went downhill, and then he took over at Ipswich, and it was just a complete nightmare. So from the retirement on the pitch up until the last, I would say, 2 years, it hasn't been the best time for Keane, but his timing is perfect now because he is ideal for the modern world in terms of how social media obsessed everything is.
See, I'd have a slightly different view, and it's not, I don't think Colin would necessarily disagree with this, that we were speaking to David Myler there on the show a couple of weeks back, and he was saying, Joe was asking him essentially, look, we hear all this stuff about Keane, the kind of, you know, the pantomime pundit and stuff like that, and, you know, he plays up to it. He's a very keenly aware man. Like, he knows his shtick, and he knows why he's there. People like this, and that, you know, there's an element of, I don't think it's false, like, this is just a facet of his personality. But Milo was talking about him when he was in Ireland, with Ireland, and saying that he was a really, really good coach. Like, he would call Keane after performances where Keane was in the stand, and Keane would give him a breakdown of particular passages of play and changes of position for Milo where he should have been maybe 3 or 4 yards across, and say, right, look, where's your danger at that point? Where is it going? Right, it's behind me, blah, 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 and talking through this stuff. So I think that Keane is aware of what he's there in a position to do. Now, I think when it translates to the managerial side, Sunderland, he was unbelievable. I mean, Sunderland were bottom of the table under, you know, Quinn was obviously settling in as a caretaker coach in, what, 2006. And they went up as champions. They went on an unbelievable run. And for United fans, and myself in particular, I was like, well, that's the succession sorted. I mean, like, you know, if in your mind's eye you're seeing the best player that you've seen playing in United's midfield bossing a team, then it works out. Now, as it goes, he's undermined by some of the personal aspects that we see and the stories that we've heard, I would argue. That seems to be my point of view. But, like, it's... My whole point is, I suppose, that he is a lot more tactically aware and a better coach than people realise. It's just that he doesn't really necessarily get asked about that stuff and get that across.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think at times we have a tendency, because of Monday Night Football and the way that Gary Neville and Jimmy Carragher break down games, we have a tendency to overcomplicate the game because they use certain terms. I mean, I remember Jose Mourinho dropped the low block term into Monday Night Football. It wasn't on Monday Night Football, it was just on Sky. And people were wondering what he was talking about. And it was just a different phrase for a low lying midfield player. And that was the low block. And I mean, the game is definitely evolved since Keane was playing in terms of passages of play, in terms of playing through the different lines. But ultimately, I don't think he is as illiterate to the modern game as people like to make out. I'd be fully on board with what you're saying, Kieran. He plays up to it. He knows what he's doing. And he's a really good success. Because, I mean, if you look at the day that Patrice Evra, who was entertaining the day that that Man United got beat 6-1 by Tottenham, and then Liverpool got beaten 7-2 by Aston Villa, on my Twitter feed, everybody was saying how big of a fumble it was from Sky Sports not to have Roy Keane on that day because of how good he would have been, how much value for money they would have gotten in terms of clicks on their site, video likes, video views. Like, that would have blown up had Roy Keane been the pundit for that defeat for Manchester United. And he's acutely aware of his value in that sense. I fully agree with what you were saying, Kieran. And I do think we do overcomplicate the game. It's a simple game at the end of the day. It just has evolved a little bit higher than we like to think. But I suppose last thoughts on Roy Keane. Where do we feel about him? What do we feel about him? Because I'm a little bit, I don't know, I'm a little bit caught in the middle of whether I like him and whether I don't like him, what my feelings are on Saipan, my feelings on the exit from United. Like, I don't know where I sit with Roy Keane, and I don't know if I'll ever know where I sit with Roy Keane in regards of his career and the controversies.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, Kieran. Go ahead.
Something came to mind, because obviously we did this roadshow with Keane Neville last year, if we haven't mentioned it enough times at this stage. But I was in and around the lads, like, afterwards or in the middle of the show. And obviously there was some quite choice comments about Ferguson and a few other things. And obviously I think that he has a his mind runs away and his mouth runs away to such an extent, and not without you know, desire to do so, but I think it runs away a little further than he would like. So in that instance afterwards, Neville said to him, "Oh, you know, I'd be careful about some of those comments about the boss." And he was genuinely like, what do you mean? Like, and it wasn't false. It wasn't kind of like, what me, Gov? So I think seeing that dynamic changed my opinion of Keane, insofar as United players were on the lookout for him there, because they know that he is generally a good person, but just can completely lose the run of himself and undermine himself. Now, look, we can argue till the cows come home about whether that's deliberate and whether that's true. But I think in terms of how it makes me view Keane as a man, it gave a little bit more of a rounding to it, because I felt like, look, you're either always a complete pantomime clown or like he's the best player that ever lived. Now, obviously, there's elements of both, but it's not that simple. So in my mind, like, he was a phenomenal player and someone I loved watching, and someone I think if the sort of truest football fan could put their personality, you know, as a player, it would be, you'd love to be Roy Keane, because it's just ferocious, like dedication, making sure you're dragging up your teammates with you. But the reality is the human side is a little bit more complicated than that.
Gollum, I know you have a story about Roy Keane that is also quite sentimental to you. So firstly, if you want to tell the listeners or the viewers what that is, and then give your thoughts on Roy Keane as a whole.
I had another Roy Keane. I'm sick of that Roy Keane story. But
oh, well, if you have another one, do tell.
Oh, got loads.
Well, the one
I met him loads of times. Ooh,
the one I'm
from Cork, and he's from Cork too.
Are you done? I have... Well, look, that story where he sent me a jersey of his, that's on otvsports.com. And that can be found. It's The Other Face of Roy Keane, it's called. And he did something very kind for me when I was at the height of my United obsession, which was sent me a signed jersey after I basically nearly died. But it was a lovely gesture, and it was very, very much telling of the man. And I'm interested that that Kieran said the perception of Keane is it's extreme. Like, you either love him or hate him, but there appears to be so much more nuance to Keane. And the story I was thinking of was that he's a big GAA man. He loves his hurling, particularly. And he was getting the train from Cork to Dublin for the, it must have been the 2013 All-Ireland Hurling Final, because it involved Clare. So it must have been that match with three of his buddies. And obviously people spotted him on the train, but people were scared to go up. And he was on the inside seat in the window seat with his three buddies. And there was this very young Clare fan who he must have only been 10 or 11 years old. And he approached Keane with his mother in his Clare jersey and kind of trembling. And then the mother said, "Hi, Roy, do you mind if my son asks you, go on, say it to him." And he was trembling, and he's like, can I have your autograph? And Roy looks him up and down and goes, "No chance." And Roy was like, not wearing that jersey, no chance. And then he was like, and he looked up to his mother and he was like, "I'm only messing, come on in. And he had a great chat with him. And I just think, like, that's what he's like, you know, like, he's a normal human being, but he's, you know, he comes with all sorts of nuance and complexity. But we probably see Roy Keane playing the character of Roy Keane on TV so much, so we're used to that side of him. But I love the other stories, because I'm kind of sick of all the box office stuff, because we're also well aware of it. But it's the stories I hear on the side from other Cork people about him are the ones that are brilliant. And I always find myself being quite harsh on him and critical, because like, he's some 20 minutes down the road, and I feel like I shouldn't praise him so much, because I'm clearly biased towards how much I love him. So I often see the other side, and I'm like, well, maybe he wasn't that great. But obviously he's, you know, we did the Cork Mount Rushmore on Off the Ball, and he was, you know, first name on my list straight away, like, no question.
Do you know what's funny? The way you talk about court there made it sound like you're all in one big WhatsApp group. It's like, you know, the stories that we have,
that would be amazing.
Taken away.
That would be the loudest WhatsApp group. That would be amazing.
Did you know Colin was from Cork, Kieran? That's
you know, it's right? Like, you know, when the cards from Donegal, it's the same. Like,
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned Seamus Coleman as well, so you're not getting away with that. And the Carl's greatest hits here as well.
Listen, we love Seamus Coleman. Who doesn't love Seamus Coleman? There's no nuance with Seamus Coleman. It is just a full on love fest, because he is the best thing to come out of Donegal in the last 15-20 years, I'd say.
He's a bit of a teacher's pet, isn't he?
Since who or what?
Oh, I don't know. Well, see, he didn't make my Cork. He didn't make my Donegal Mount Rushmore. So I'm sort of like stuttering a little bit here.
Just terrible.
He's Donegal's second son at the minute, after Michael Murphy. That's where I'm going to put him at.
Jim McGuinness?
No, Jim McGuinness didn't make the Mount Rushmore either. Well, I selected him. I selected him, but Kieran Cunningham took him off. So I'm not taking the blame for that at all. But also, Colin, there's no place for nuance on Team 33. It's either he's great, he's amazing, best player ever, or he's terrible. That's four options you get when you're talking about someone. So we're going to just nip that in the bud for the next one, all right? No more nuance.
Splinters in the arse with Al Berg, isn't it? Just always on the fence, never off.
He's thinking.
Yeah, for the listener.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, yeah.
He's thinking of a response. I don't have time for you to think of your response, because I do have to get into work, because I'm talking to Ono Callaghan after the break about his new book, Roy Keane, The Origins, and there will be plenty more stories. Some of them we have touched on here, some of them we haven't. So coming up after the break, Ono Callaghan on Roy Keane, The Origins.
Get in there. That's what I pay you for.
I think conceit and arrogance is part of a man's makeup. Perhaps I've got too much.
I believe in a different concept of football to Don.
We don't play in the clouds. If God wanted us to play football in the clouds, he'd put grass there.
And that might mean, you know, aiming for utopia, and it might mean being a little bit stupid. But that is the way I am.
And if anything is going to win second division this season, it's character. And I've got it.
How do you react, though, when someone, you know, from your playing staff comes and says, boss, I think you're doing this wrongly?
Good. Well, I ask him which way he thinks it should be done, and then we talk about it for 20 minutes, and then we decide I was right.
Oh, you are a bloody disgrace! For missing the target from there, you're one bloody shooting!
We get in too much of that, and I suggest you shut up and show more football.
Happiness comes with insight.
I'm a little bit of an idealist.
I'm a good socialist.
I do believe in fairies.
I'm a good dad.
And that is my, you know, outlook.
I'm happy.
Okay, smash it.
Give us a kiss.
So a lot of people know Roy Keane as the angry pundit, the pantomime villain, the person who's not afraid to tell it like it is on TV. But of course, he was once a fabulous footballer for Manchester United, for Celtic, for Ireland, amongst others. But how was his career shaped? That is what we're going to delve into tonight on Team 33. Welcome along. I'm Enda Call. Now, if you want to listen back to any of the show, if you've missed any of it, you can find it as part of the OTB Podcast Network, available now on the OTB Sports app, or you can catch the longer version of this interview on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/offtheball. I am talking about Roy Keane tonight because I'm joined on the line by Ono Callaghan, author of Keane, The Origins. I wish I had the book with me in studio right now. I forgot it at home because the cover is absolutely beautiful, Owen.
Here you go.
There we go. For anybody watching on YouTube.
There you go. Wow. Here's one I made earlier.
Yeah. For radio listeners, it's sort of a painting version of Roy Keane in his early days for Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, it's actually photographed from the 1991 FA Cup final. And it was done by an illustrator over here, actually. I'm based in Toronto. And it's funny when you're dealing with somebody who has very, very little knowledge or information about Roy Keane, and you kind of sit down with him and he's asking you questions about what he's like and, you know, what can we incorporate in the design. And it was actually a great thing to be involved in terms of that illustration and trying to get across exactly what the book is about, which is obviously these formative years of his career and his life. And I think that the expression on the front cover kind of sums it up really nicely. You know, his mouth is kind of a little bit open and he's kind of, it's almost like he's disbelieving of what's happening around him. And obviously that moment, it's a cup final at Wembley Stadium. And, you know, you rewind even 12 months earlier, and he was unemployed in Cork, you know, watching his peers from Rockmount and the Irish and the Rich set up, get opportunities in England. And he was really back where it all began, and, you know, the north side of Cork City, and basically his dreams going down the toilet. And, you know, I guess one of the big things about this book is the sliding doors moments, you know, where I guess it's a footballer's life in many respects. You know, you know, one day you're given a cold shoulder and the next day you're flavour of the month. And certainly in Roy Keane's case, that there was a multitude of those moments where it really could have gone either way. And obviously in his case, he got to live out his fantasy.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the illustrator didn't really know much about Roy Keane. There aren't too many people on this side of the water that don't know too much about Roy Keane, and there's been a multitude of things written about him. TV coverage is nonstop, especially now with Sky Sports. He's had two books written himself. What made you think about this angle for a book for Roy Keane, and what made you write this book?
Oof. Like, I really should come up with a better answer to this question, because I've been asked it a few times. And the honest answer is, I wrote a piece very reluctantly about the 25th anniversary of him signing for Manchester United, which would have been the summer of 2018. And like, as you mentioned, you know, even at that time, he was very, very public facing. He was involved, obviously, as an assistant to Martin O'Neill. You know, from an Irish perspective, he was probably more prominent than he was as a player. Footage of him was always out there, and I really got the impression that people were sick and tired of hearing about him. So, you know, when this story cropped up and he was asked about writing a feature, I was kind of like, oh, not keen again. You know, obviously as well, an Irish sports journalist, they've written so much about him, talked so much about him, and you're like, is there anything fresh that I can say about this guy? So I wrote this feature about the build up to the transfer to Manchester United. So I kind of focused on this period of about 1992. And the angle really was, how did he become a record-breaking transfer? Like, what persuaded all these clubs to line up wanting to bring him to their organizations? Because obviously it wasn't just Manchester United, and it wasn't just Blackburn either. And the more I got into this time period, and the more I got into who he was around this time, the more I got into the archive and the comments from various people around the game in England, the more fascinated I became with this sort of window of Keane's life and his career. And obviously you go back to source material, so you go back to his first book, and he just really skips through the Nottingham Forest time. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously that's just the joys of publishing, right? They want you to get to the juicy stuff. They obviously want them to get to Manchester United and to go big on the high profile stars and what this person's like, and you know, what he found annoying about this guy and blah blah blah. And so that kind of played to my advantage as well, that even from Keane's own perspective, he didn't go into much detail regarding his time with Forrest and his time under Clough. And I just felt that it started to kind of build a little bit in my mind, and once the piece went out there and we published the piece on the 42, the sort of reaction that came back was very surprising. It was like people saying, thanks so much for, you know, bringing some attention to this time of his life. You know, I had totally forgotten about this. I had totally forgotten about these people that were around him. You know, his Forest career is really kind of underappreciated and all that sort of stuff. Because I do think there's a lot of people out there who probably feel that Roy Keane's career starts when he signs for Manchester United, which is really grossly unfair to what he accomplished at Forest and the importance of his time at City Ground. And so you kind of rolled all of that together into a mixing pot, and you jot down a few other ideas. And, you know, I was talking to Mercia Press. They said, look, do you have any ideas? And I kind of said, I have one idea. And it turned out to be this book, really. And, you know, it's funny because I look back on, in terms of what I tend to write about in like long form features, and they're usually very niche and they're usually, you know, very, very unique. And I end up with my first book writing about the biggest high profile Irish sports star of all time, which is kind of funny to me. But I guess in one sense, the type of stories that I write are trying to shine a light on things that have gone under the radar. So I think in many respects, maybe the content of this book still kind of fits into what I do best, I guess.
Yeah, and I suppose any sort of football documentary, sports documentary, when you look back at someone's career, it's generally the highlight. So you don't hear too much about Zidane's time when he was growing up in France. You hear little things about Brazilian players and the struggles that they had in the favelas growing up, and little things like that, but you never really truly go deep into their childhoods. And I suppose it's very similar to Roy Keane. A lot of people would know that he played League of Ireland, but some people may not know what club he played for in Cork before that, or even how he got on at Cove during his time there. And one of the things that I thought you brought to life quite well, and it is something that I really liked about the book, is that throughout his Cove career, throughout the Rockman career, there's a lot of disappointments for Keane. He was always seen as a little bit too small for the standard of play that he wanted to play. He was overlooked quite a bit, but even when he signed for Cove, and he is this up-and-coming star, I like that you didn't make too much of what he actually was, because I feel like looking back at these periods of their career, you always find people that would say that they always knew he was going to be a star, and that, you know, this guy, it was always written on the wall, it was inevitable that it would go over. But you, the depth of people that you spoke to worked so closely with Keane that they weren't going to make that kind of judgment. They were going to tell you the truth about it. And he wasn't always just this massive star. He genuinely had struggles.
The biggest thing, I guess, about him when he's going through his teenage years is that there were doubts. There were constant doubts about him. And, you know, even when he's spotted by Noel McCabe on that famous, almost cinematic day at Fairview Park, in that moment, his life changes. That's not even a League of Ireland game. That's a youth game. And he really shouldn't even have been there, because, you know, by that stage, he was a fully-fledged first-team squad member and a regular starter for Cove Ramblers in the League of Ireland First Division. And he really was doing a favour. He was still eligible to play, so it was a game. And, you know, it was Belvedere. You could get one over on a high-profile sort of side. And you know, that game was even a replay. And, you know, Cove really should have won that first game. You talk about sliding doors again. But... you know, that afternoon, Noel McCabe was even going to see a different player. He was going to watch Jamie Cullimore, who was Cove Ramblers' left winger. So, you know, even in terms of the scouts and what they were looking for, Keane wasn't on the list. You know, and you call it whatever, a twist of fate or, you know, something else, coincidence, I'm not sure. But that day, Noel McCabe saw something. And it's funny, like, one of the guys I speak to in this book is Graham Brereton, who was playing for Belvedere that afternoon. And Brereton was actually marking Jamie Cullimore, and he marked him out of the game. So in many respects, you know, Graham Brereton is probably responsible for Jamie Cullimore not getting a trial at Nottingham Forest and possibly turning into Roy Keane. But Graham kind of says, you know, Belvedere absolutely hockeyed Cove Ramblers that afternoon. And he was like, you know, our two central midfielders were terrific. They really bossed it. And, you know, I obviously had a good game because Jamie Cullimore was frozen out. And he kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, like, why didn't Noel McCabe give us a glowing recommendation in his scouting report? You know, and I guess that's the joys of football. You know, you see something, somebody else sees something completely differently. And, you know, even Keane himself, you know, again, that, I think that moment gets romanticized, right? Mm. Like, you know, Noel McCabe goes there and sees Keane and is, you know, and it's kind of very compelling content. But, you know, Tony Gorman, who is one of Roy's closest allies on the Foss course that he was on at the same time, remembers Keane meeting him later that night and explaining the fact that he'd been approached by McCabe and that Forrest might be interested in bringing him over. And Keane's like, I can't really believe it because he didn't even play very well.
Yeah.
So there's so many layers to it. And again, Keane is a figure historically who always needs to be placed in context. And I think because Keane is such a cultish is the wrong word to use, but I think people love the myth around Roy Keane, and the realness is boring. What they like is they like to invest in a kind of a version of Keane that suits their own perspective on him. And like, I kind of really wanted to try with this book to separate really two Roy Keanes. You know, that there's a guy who people desperately want to be dark and depressive and maybe struggle with psychological issues and, you know, be very, very damning and, you know, extremely acerbic to the point where he's hurtful relentlessly. And I just think that the true version of Roy Keane is a lot softer than that. And it's certainly not something that's been sparked later in life. I think he's always had this, and I don't even think it's a darkness. I think it's, I just think he's impatient. I think he's a guy who just would like to spend time doing something constructive. So, you know, for him, spending time in a classroom was not something constructive. When, you know, one of his mates in the Rockmo team says that, you know, he's not going training because he's got a new skateboard and he wants to play with a skateboard, Keane is like, obviously just like, so, you know, he can't control his emotions. Like, why would you rather play with a skateboard and go training and play football? Like, what's wrong with you? And the same way on the FOSS course, you know, sitting in front of a computer screen trying to learn computers, and, you know, he just turns his off and tells the teacher, like, I have no interest, so there's no point. I would rather be outside playing football. Jamie Cullmore talks of how he would shorten his lunch breaks. You know, instead of taking 45 minutes for a lunch break, he'd take 20 minutes, grab a ball and go out and just practice his free kicks or something. So I think that he was a kind of a ball of energy, and probably as well wrapped up in that was the fact that he'd been overlooked so frequently. And he probably felt the need to work harder because it wasn't coming as easy to him as it was for other people. You know, he wasn't the type of player at that time, you know, like he wasn't a strapping centre back like Paul McCarthy was, who was eye catching maybe to scouts because he was bigger and he was a bit more commanding and he could, you know, head a ball in the air and get the better of a centre forward. He wasn't like Alan O'Sullivan, who was a really flashy winger in that Rockmoon team as well, and obviously could beat two or three players and stick one in the top corner. And again, it's an eye catching sort of thing. He didn't have those elements within his game. And ultimately, as it turned out, the irony to that is when he is spotted and you look at Noel McCabe's scouting report, Keane, I think, made a point of working on his overall skill set as a player, because I think he saw, particularly in the likes of his own brother, Dennis, who was a winger, and considered to be the most naturally talented footballer in the Keane family. I think you could see it with Jamie Cullmore as well that afternoon at Belvedere, where Jamie didn't have enough in his overall game to kind of get away from Graham Brereton and have any sort of contribution to that into that fixture. And also he could see it from somebody like Alan O'Sullivan, who went to Luton Town as the best player on that Rockmount side and then didn't make the grade. Again, he was a winger, and Keane probably looked at these guys and saw maybe a one-dimensional aspect to their game. And if he could become more fully rounded, and if he could become a guy who was sort of 8 out of 10 when it came to 4 or 5 different elements, well, then he was probably going to stand a better chance. And, you know, as it turned out, you know, that afternoon at Fairview Park, you look at McCabe's scouting report, it's like his tackling, his heading, his determination, his ability to find a pass. You know, McCabe highlights like a litany of different elements within Keane's game. It wasn't, this player is great at beating player. He's great at beating defenders, has a great turn of pace and a great shot. You're like, well, yeah, you know, you could have just caught them on a good day. Whereas I think Keane, he just was a little bit more fully rounded. And I think he had specifically worked on that very, very hard to try to give himself that best opportunity. That if something was to change, if somebody did see him somewhere, that he did have a more all-encompassing ability on the field. And I think that that's really what the FOSS course did for him as well. It just kind of, it all knitted together. And from Keane, in terms of like where he was in the summer of 1989 versus where he was in the spring of 1990, I think that there had been a massive development in how he was as a footballer.
Yeah, and the fundamentals of the game is something that plays a big part in his relationship with Brian Clough later on in the book. And I think that's sort of well documented already, that, you know, Clough is very much a get the ball, pass the ball. There's the famous story about what he first asked him to do at Anfield during his debut. For those listening that don't know what the FOSS course was, I don't want to give too much away about the book because obviously we want people to go out and read it. But what was exactly the FOSS course? Because I certainly didn't know going into this book that he was on a FOSS course that was based around football.
Yeah. So really, obviously, Ireland in the late 80s was a particularly bleak place. And FOSS was a government initiative, which is basically like a training scheme. So because so many people were unemployed, you know, the government instigated this scheme where they would offer education and training, and people would come off social welfare and they would enroll in a FOSS course, and they would be given X amount per week, because they were obviously seen to be trying to further their development educationally. And now, obviously, you know, I think a lot of people will look back at that and say it's the government just fiddling the numbers. They could get people off the unemployment register, but they're just basically putting them on a different type of register and calling it something else. But as it turned out in 1989, a lot of companies, a lot of organizations could find through FOSS an opportunity to kind of like get people on their books. And one of those organizations was the FAI. So the FAI partnered with FOSS, and their whole plan was to have this initiative for young footballers in the country. They would do it through the League of Ireland, where all of the League of Ireland clubs in the Premier Division and the First Division would send two players. They would shortlist two of their young players. And those two players from each club would come to Dublin for a 9-month, may even have been slightly longer than that, but from kind of September to like, you know, May of the following year, they would come to Dublin, they would live in Dublin Monday to Friday, so they would stay in digs, and they would have like intense, technical, proficient, you know, really, really dedicated, in-depth training Monday through Friday. And then, because obviously they were very, very talented young players, a lot of them, obviously all of them were connected to League of Ireland clubs, then they would go back to their clubs and play at the weekends. So they were effectively getting Monday to Friday sort of proper professional training, and then going back and using that training in a League of Ireland situations on the weekends. Roy Keane was one of Cove Ramblers' representatives, even though, you know, Cork City had desperately wanted to sign him, and that fell through because of a registration mishap. And he went up with Jamie Cullimore. So they were the two Cove Ramblers representatives. They go up on a train every Monday morning up to Palmerstown. And it's an incredible thing when you're writing it. And you know, this is Keane as an 18-year-old. And I guess it's that moment of your life where a lot of people will go to third level education. So you're kind of like finding out more about yourself, and your personality is developing. And Keane's kind of college stint was a FOSS course. Yeah. You know, he had signed for Cove at that stage, and he'd go up on a Monday, and you'd stay in your digs in the evening times. You'd sit in and watch TV or whatever. You'd hang out maybe on a Thursday, go to a nightclub with the lads, go for your few pints, and then get the train back down to Cork on a Friday. Or obviously, if there's a certain fixture somewhere else, you might stay up for an extra day or whatever, if it was easier for travel. And Keane did that. Keane did that from September 1989, right through till May of 1990. And you know, at that stage, obviously he already trialed at Nottingham Forest, and the deal was pretty much done and dusted. And then in the summertime, he headed off to Forest and was there permanently from that moment onwards. But the FOSS course was, you know, a really, really intensive thing for Keane. Obviously, it enabled him to get bigger physically, enabled him to certainly develop technically, and also, you know, rub shoulders with really elite talent. I mean, you know, if you looked at it, guys like Pat Fenlon had been over in England, had just been over in England. In Fenlon's case, it was Chelsea. He was let go. So there was a lot of guys in that FOSS course who were kind of drinking in the last chance saloon. You know, they'd already been in England and hadn't made the grade, and now they were back and trying to maybe reset again and try to make a right contact or a right bit of networking to maybe get them over across channel once again and maybe as a better footballer, more developed footballer. And it was, you know, the atmosphere there was pretty, pretty strained at times, you know, because you're ultimately competing with each other. You know, if there's a multitude of midfielders there, well, not all of you are gonna get the call. And so it's kind of survival of the fittest. And I think Keane always likes those odds. You know, I think that sort of competitive nature of it, if it was a kind of a relatively calm and delicate sort of training program, I don't think Keane would have lasted. I think the fact that it was very intense and that it was sort of the creme de la creme of young players in the country, I think it really suited him in terms of his personality and his mindset. And it really set up, I mean, if you, you know, there's obviously a lot of guys from that Foss course interviewed in the book, and they will say that, you know, when he arrived, you know, he was a fine player. He was an okay player. You know, he was all right. But by the spring of the following year, he was definitely the most improved on that course.
Yeah.
And again, you get a growth spurt, you know, you're learning things left, right, and center. And it's funny, Larry Manny, his coach on that Foss course, you know, always talks about watching him in one game. You know, they obviously played these kind of training games. You know, they might play one game against an Ireland underage setup, might be another game against St. Pat's, or might be another game against Bray Wanderers, whatever it was. And again, those games, you know, absolutely, like, no prisoners were taken. And Keane, in this one game, Larry Manny remembers him playing it right back. And it's funny listening to Larry, like, recollect it, because he says, I remember watching him playing in this position, and he was so controlled and so calm and had the intelligence to just sort of innately know what to do. And Larry had that moment of realization on the touchline where he's like, I don't even think he's ever played this position before. And again, Larry's big thing about Keane, and obviously he worked with him every day on that Foss course, was his ability to step up. And he kind of made this, he frequently used this phrase, you know, you watched him at Forest, and every opportunity he got, he made the step up. There was never any moment where Keane regressed. You know, it was, you know, Clough would tap him on the shoulder. Okay, you're going in and you're playing the left wing. Okay, boss. Okay, right, Roy, you're going in, you're playing centre half. Okay, boss. Okay, Roy, today we're using you up front with Nigel. Okay, boss. And it's that Keane, for whatever reason, that belief in him, in himself, the fact that he felt so comfortable in his skin as a player. And I guess it comes back to that belief and that confidence. You know, famous story of when he clashes with Paddy Bonner on a youth trip. You know, he goes with the Ireland youth team to Malta to play a qualifier. And Maurice Setters is the coach. And Maurice Setters, I have no idea why he did this. He brought 17 players to Malta for his game. And he announced a match day squad of 16. So there was one player who was left out completely and had to suffer the humiliation of that and not get stripped. And that player was Roy Keane.
Yeah.
And you think of the sort of trauma of this, you know, obviously now we're much more learned in terms of our approach to young people, you know, how, you know, certain situations can be traumatic for them. And particularly from a coaching perspective, we need to be more cerebral and we need to be more communicative and we need to be on their level. And you think of all these kind of setbacks that Keane had, and they're all listed in the book, you know, I'm not going to mention all of them, but, you know, this trip to Malta. So Keane obviously has to sit on this, you know, this disappointment, and again, this sort of gnawing thing that he's still never good enough for his country. And he sits on it for 24 hours because also on that trip is the senior Republic of Ireland side, because they're in Malta for a World Cup qualifier. And they beat Malta, which secures their place at Italia 90. So 24 hours after the U team game, there's a big knees up. So the U players mingle with the senior squad. They all have a few drinks. Roy has far too many drinks because he's obviously drowning his sorrows.
Yeah.
And there's this moment where Paddy Bonner and Mick McCarthy are leaving. And, you know, Paddy Bonner, you know, always a very courteous guy and a very polite guy, a very genuine guy, says hello to the lads, and a drunken Roy starts on him and says, you're absolutely shit. And if, you know, only for Gerry Payton being fucking worse than you, you know, you wouldn't even be getting your game. And, you know, he's with Richie Purdy and Tommy Dunn, two of his teammates from the youth side. And obviously you can kind of see it in the moment, them sort of like, you know, mouths wide open at this like lippy Corkonian who's had a few beers too many. And he's absolutely annihilated a legendary Irish figure, football figure. And Paddy obviously laughs it off. But like back in the Foss course, when his story starts doing the rounds, you know, Tommy Dunn saying to one of the boys, like, Roy can't even get his game for the U team, but still he's having a go at like a guy who's got 65 caps for his country.
Yeah.
And I think that there was this sort of like, Keane felt comfortable enough, even when he's like 18, to have a go at Paki Bonner. There's no reason why you should feel that, because like you should feel a degree of inferiority, and you know, thou shalt not say two words to these guys because they're operating on a different level. But Keane would do it repeatedly, and I guess like there's never a magic moment in the book where you kind of come upon why he has this massive belief in himself. You know, there is a moment where he's in Cork, you know, at the train station one Monday morning, and you know, the boys are in their carriage and they're about to pull out of Kent Station and head to Dublin, and it's one of those, you know, that you can see it's a you know, probably a frosty cold morning in Cork, and you know, there's guys working on the train tracks, and it's early in the morning, and Keane looks out the window and he sees basically the ghost of Christmas Future. Right, I mean, it's hard labor, it's Cork at that moment in time, you know, probably felt like Cork was in recession for about 15 years. You know, like it had lost obviously a lot of their big employers, and Keane's own father was affected by that, and a whole generation of people kind of like just scrambling around for work and to make ends meet. And here was Keane like doing this FOSS course in Dublin, trying to be a footballer. And he looks out the window at these guys who are battering the train tracks, you know, hard labor. And he just turns to Jamie Cullimore and he says, I have to make it as a footballer. I have to make it. And I'm not sure if it's I have to make it because I cannot for the life of me be out on a train track, you know, and doing that sort of work because I feel that I'm something else. I'm not quite sure what he meant by that statement. You know, like in many respects, it could be an empty statement. You know, it's like, I want to be a millionaire. Okay, fair enough. Like we all do. But like, yeah, but I think Keane knew that he was on something like a pathway. It was just figuring out the right route to take, because, you know, he was an excellent footballer. Everybody adored him in Cork. You know, everybody felt that he really should be cross-channel. Everybody felt that he was getting a hard time, that he wasn't being afforded the opportunities that he should be afforded. So he knew that he was in the right space. It was just something quite wasn't lining up for him. And then obviously you fast forward, you go through all of that, the League of Ireland, Cove Ramblers, that base, that hard kind of physical stuff in a first division environment mixed with the FOSS course. You know, I guess that's the magic ingredients mixed with his confidence, his personality. But in terms of where he got that from, I've no idea. Like it's a mystery to me. Like he shouldn't really have been as confident. He shouldn't really have been that sort of mouthy, gobby young fella. You know, he should have been the guy who sort of minded his P's and Q's. And you compare it, interestingly enough, to when he goes to Nottingham Forest. You know, he is in no way argumentative. He is in no way a person who stands up to guys in positions of authority, i.e. Brian Clough. The fact that the main reason why Clough loved Keane so much, and you bring it back to his moment, his you know, again, you come back to a myth, that mythical moment of his Anfield debut. You know, he comes up to Brian Clough's house and Clough hands him a milk bottle, you know, and putting the bottles out. So like, finish that for me, Roy. And Roy goes, well, I don't like milk. And there's this moment of like Clough's handing in the bottle and Keane saying, I don't like milk. And Clough standing there saying, well,
it's either you drink it or you don't.
Yeah, yeah. It's the fork in the road moment again.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And the reason I love that Paki Bonner story so much is because in the build up to it, you're getting to know Keane as a teen during this book, and you're almost like, oh, where is this? Where you like, you hear stories about some of the mouthing on the pitch, and you're seeing a little bit of his personality develop, and then you have this Paki Bonner story, and then you're like, yeah, there you go. There's the Keane that you know. And it's just interesting the iron focus that he had at that age to get to Nottingham Forest. And then I think that's what comes into it when he, especially that milk bottle story. Keane always knew how to do it. He just needed to be given an opportunity, which he wasn't given quite a bit. And then once he knew how to take the opportunity, he took it with both feet.
I think for anyone listening to this and for anyone watching this, I would urge them all to take however long it is, 20 minutes, 30 minutes if you can, go on YouTube and watch Roy Keane's moments for Nottingham Forest. Because firstly, Keane was a completely different player at Forest than he was at Manchester United. He was an attacking midfielder for a start. So he contributed in the build-up to goals. He scored goals. He was at times a playmaker. And again, to bring it back to Larry Manny, who was his coach in the Foss course, like Larry, you know, remembers watching him playing for Forest in his debut season. And, you know, he said to me, he's like, I was of the opinion that Keane went over there and slotted into games and said, this is fucking easy. And like, even, you know, one of his mates, Darren Barry, who was also there, another guy from Cork who signed for Forest at the very, very same time in a kind of a really weird, quirky sort of way. One player went one way, one player went the other sort of thing. And Darren's like, I would, you know, and Darren played with Keane at Rockmount. And he said, I would never have thought of Roy as a quick player. And then I'm watching him for Forest. And he's like an Olympic sprinter. Mm. He looks like he's covering every blade of grass. Just the appetite, the hunger, the speed, the quickness. And, you know, like it was Brian Rice who was, who's now manager of Hamilton Academical in Scotland, who was at Forest at the time as well, a more senior member of the squad. And he saw Keane playing in those very, very early reserve games. And, you know, the famous one was him against Arnold Town. And Brian Rice watched him in this game. And he said, my memory was watching this kid do things on the pitch that we didn't have in our team. There was, he was playing, I think he was playing wide in midfield in that game. And Rice is thinking to himself, wingers don't do that. Like wingers don't track back and make tackles like that. I mean, wingers did a certain job at that time. Wingers fulfilled certain duties. Fullbacks did likewise. And Keane, and again, you bring it back to what Clough saw. You know, Clough, you know, saw a very, very brief glimpse of Keane playing a reserve team football. But if Clough's opinion was a similar of opinion to Brian Rice's, we do not have anyone in our first team who plays like this. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Because, you know, in terms of that Liverpool debut, you know, the whole thing of like, oh, well, you know, Keane was called up, you know, there was an emergency and Keane was called, you know, and I say it in the book, again, it comes back to myths. And I think a lot of people want to believe in a Brian Clough myth. Like management in football is 99% of the time boring logistics. Who's fit for the weekend? Who can give us 20 minutes off the bench? Who's carrying a knock? Who's carrying a yellow card? If they get booked tonight, they're over the next cup game. You know, let's look two games ahead. So if we play one of the young lads tonight, can he, you know, who can come back in a fortnight and play again, blah, blah, blah. And people instead want to concentrate on the halftime team talks. They want to concentrate on those incredible moments of inspiration that a manager will say to a player to G them up. And, you know, yes, that happens, but, you know, in a very, very small amount of time. And Clough, for me, clearly wanted Keane at Anfield. He had seen something in Keane, and he, you know, the other thing about Clough was he always gave young players a debut away from home, because he always felt that if the young player got stage fright and struggled, well, at least it would be away fans only who saw the kid have basically a difficult evening, and that it wouldn't be 25,000 at the City Ground going, oh my God, this kid can never come back and play again for us, because it was so humiliating. Because, you know, that the whole circumstances about the build up to Anfield are just, it, you know, it's like it's perfectly orchestrated, and Clough loved that sort of stuff. He loved that orchestration, loved getting in people's heads. And, you know, the whole thing about, you know, he came up to me in the dressing room and said, you know, and what are you doing? I'm putting out the jerseys. Oh, well, pull one on yourself because you're going out and playing. You're like, the chances of that actually, you know, like that might have been what Keane remembers, but it's certainly, it's guaranteed to be not what Clough did. I mean, you can't be that off the cuff playing in first, you know, in first division and you're at a club like Nottingham Forest. It just does not happen. And also, like, in the circumstance of that game, Franz Kerr, who was a right winger, and Keane played on the right wing that night, you know, Franz Kerr was dropped. So, like, I mean, people go on about, like, oh, there was emergencies, there was injuries, and Steve Hodge had the flu. And you're like, yeah, but Phil Starbuck came in and replaced Steve Hodge. Roy Keane came in to replace Franz Carr, and Franz Carr was dropped. So, you know, the actual thought process is a little bit different than how it's kind of played out. And, you know, it's like that relationship with Clough is an amazing one for me. You know, you think of all these moments that stand out. And obviously Keane's got a certain persona. He even still had a persona in Forest. You know, he's a young guy and he didn't have much money, certainly at that time, in his back pocket, but he had money in his back pocket. So you go out and you enjoy yourself, you have a few beers or whatever. And, you know, going through those seasons, that reputation grew increasingly. But there's this moment where Clough, in that final season, 92-93, Forest aren't playing very well. And there's, you know, they're obviously kind of struggling, you know, the bottom half of the table. They might have even been bottom of the league even at that stage. And there's a big piece done in The Observer with Clough, a big interview. And they ask him about pressure, you know, like, you know, how do you feel this season? And you're struggling and could this be the end and blah, blah, blah. And Clough, as he did, you know, he plays things into perspective. And he said, you know, you talk to me about pressure. You're talking to me about, you know, setbacks or all, you know, that sort of stuff. And he starts talking about going to a children's home specialised in special needs, those suffering with special needs, and which is something that he used to do a lot and visit these kids, spend a lot of time with them. And he brought two players with him. And the one player was Nigel, obviously his son, right? Very polite, very pleasant, lovely haircut. You know, you could just see him there, just a very nice young man, as Clough himself would say. And the other player wasn't Stuart Pearce, the captain. It wasn't Steve Chettle, who was born and bred in the city. It wasn't, Brian Laws, more experienced figure. It was Roy Keane. And you talk of the sort of a moment like that for a young guy, you have to be a bit vulnerable. You have to be a bit open-minded. You have to be patient. You have to be understanding. You have to be a whole load of things that you wouldn't really ever associate with a guy like Roy Keane. And yet in that instance, Clough turns to Keane to bring him into this sort of situation. And I kind of love that story so much. And it's a really throwaway thing. Clough doesn't really make a big deal of it, but he just shares the anecdote to put things in perspective in terms of stress and pressure and management and all that sort of stuff. To actually say, this is real pressure. This is real struggle for these kids on their day-to-day lives to have to go through this. And it's Keane who's there, you know, and I guess a lot of stuff in this book is kind of debunking, you know, maybe certain things are debunked and other things we kind of maybe try to shine a light on possibly an alternative version. And so, you know, again, you come back to that, the dark, moody, menacing, aggressive, combative guy. And you're like, well, that doesn't sound like any of those things, right? And particularly when you're at that age where you could easily just be foolish and immature and not the right person for that sort of situation. At Forest, you know, I've said this before, but I think John Lennon always said that, you know, Elvis died the day he joined the US Army, you know, and when he finished his stint with the Army, he came back and he was somebody else. And when Roy Keane joins Manchester United, Keane becomes someone else because he has to. He has to conform to the pressure of a high-profile club, a very, very rich, historically significant sort of organisation. And you have to kind of just temper certain things and you have to be more careful. And also as a player, he changes. I think definitely the first two seasons he's at United, he struggles. Regarding his place in that team and how he can properly contribute, moving from a very possession-based side, a very patient side in how they looked at a game, versus a counter-attacking side with two lightning-quick wingers, with a guy like Cantona, who was just a jack-of-all-trades, orchestrating everything, Keane struggling to come to terms with how am I actually playing in this side? Like, what am I supposed to be doing? You know, so I think that there's a purity to him at Forest. You know, he's given a freedom by Clough to just basically do whatever he wants on the pitch, because Clough kind of looks at him as something just like completely fresh and something that's organic and just probably shouldn't be shouldn't be overtrained and shouldn't just be, you know, you know, obviously Clough used to bring his dog for a walk along the River Trent every morning, and a bit like that, you know, I let the dog off the leash and the dog just roams free.
Yeah.
And I think that Keane was a bit like that at Forest, we, under Clough's tutelage. Obviously, you know, you have to be, you know, you have to be a collaborator within a very experienced Forest dressing room. But it's funny, you know, you talk to guys at Forest at the time, you know, Robert Rosario, who joined Forest in the latter half of 1993 when everything was falling through the floor and relegation was on the horizon. And, you know, Rosario joined and he was like, I walked into the dressing room. He's like, I couldn't believe that he was a 21-year-old who was just ruling the roost. He was a 21-year-old who was looked upon as the inspiration, as the game changer, as the driving force, and, you know, rubbing shoulders with a lot of guys with plenty of experience under their belts. It was Keane who very, very clearly was, you know, and Rosario refers to him as a rock star, you know, in the book. He just carried himself in a different way. Like he was just, and very, very clearly he couldn't stay at Forest. You know, that was just, you know, he had got to the stage where he'd outgrown this club. And but it's funny, you know, even at that age, and comparing the way the Keane was when he arrived at that club, and it was kind of yes sir, no sir, falling in line with everything. And you fast forward to that final season, Clough had obviously become a peripheral figure at that stage, and he wasn't really involved in the day-to-day running of the club, which probably gave Keane a little bit more opportunity to really kind of take control and his voice to be heard a little bit more. But you know, that again, that development. And the only way that you succeed in a Manchester United dressing room with Steve Bruce, Brian Robson, Mark Hughes, Peter Schmeichel, Paul Ince, is if you've put the work in. And in Forest, Keane absorbed and he learned from these figures around him, the likes of Des Walker, the likes of Stuart Pearce, and learned how to be this sort of football figure. It's very easy to be a guy who just does stuff on the pitch, and then off you go and Bob's your uncle, no problem. But I think at Forest he also learned how to be a leader, which obviously serves him so importantly later on in his United career. And I think, again, you come back to why the Forest period is so important to Keane. That's just an added layer to it, you know, and to for him to be growing into something that's really all-encompassing. You know, like we were talking earlier on, the importance of his skill set to be rounded the same way, preparing himself for a move elsewhere. I think Keane felt it important to be rounded. You know, before he leaves, he buys his first house. You know, he buys a house in Scarrington, which is in kind of like about 20 miles outside Nottingham, and it's a farmhouse. And it just seemed to be a mature thing to do, right? It's almost like Keane kind of, it's time to move out of, you know, the city centre, and it's time to move away from the nightclubs because I'm kind of becoming a different version of myself. Obviously, I think you're keen. He was trying hard to sell himself that story.
Yeah.
But so he was trying very hard to kind of take on added responsibility. And that obviously was even in the way that he lived, the location where he was based, how he socialised in comparison to what he was doing in the early days.
Well, in terms of perspective, it certainly is a completely different perspective on things and on Roy Keane especially. And I really, really enjoyed reading the book. And it's not too often these books can actually capture your imagination, but you really do have it come out of from reading it with a completely different idea of how Roy Keane became who he is. And yeah, for that, I just say brilliant work.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's... For anyone wanting to learn about stuff, salacious stuff, or for anybody wanting to learn about bust ups or, you know, irritations or arguments, all I will say is Keane is a guy who, yes, obviously has a temper, but he has a trigger. And the temper usually is as a result of the trigger. Rarely does he just randomly kind of, you know, descent into madness. You know, if you go back through the big controversies in his career, the big dramas, you know, you take something as simple as when he stamps on Gareth Southgate, right? Semi-final FA Cup 1995. and kind of lost in that, right? It's obviously a horrible thing to do to anybody, but lost in that is how horrendous Soke's challenge is on him, like just before it. Like Soke is a leg-breaking challenge. And obviously Keane's already injured because Darren Patterson's done him earlier in the game. So like Keane stamps on Soke because it's kind of like it's a reactionary thing. And this book, it doesn't explain Saipan. It doesn't explain Alfie Haaland. But it does inform it. Because I think that Keane, from a very early age, has been consistent in how he approaches things. If you wrong him, if you treat him like shit, if you try to break him down, he will remember it and he will let you know. Much the same way that, you know, on his debut, Ronnie Whelan does him at Anfield. You know, he comes in and absolutely, you know, basically cuts him in two with a challenge. And I was, you know, welcome to Anfield. This is the big leagues. You know, there's no sort of like, oh, how are you, another Irish fella? Like, I'll take care of you. Like, you know, I'll treat you nice and I'll treat you with kid gloves. It was welcome to the big leagues, bang. And the start of the 92-93 season, Nottingham Forest are playing Liverpool on the opening day. And it's a televised game, as far as I can remember. And Forest, it's funny, it's a metaphor for Forest season. It's the best moment of the entire campaign for Nottingham Forest. Everything else just goes like ridiculously quickly down the toilet from that moment onwards, because they beat Liverpool that afternoon. Teddy Sheringham scored a winner. And before moving to Tottenham, probably a few days later. But during that game, Keane is very, very fortunate not to get sent off. And the guy that's on the receiving end of the challenge is one Ronnie Whelan. And it's obviously a very, very, very bad challenge. And Keane gets a yellow card. But when the teams are coming off at half-time, Dean Saunders walks over to Ronnie Whelan and he says, what's the deal with you and Keane? And Ronnie Whelan's going, what do you mean? He's like, well, as the referee was showing him a yellow card and he was walking backwards, all he kept saying was, that's for fucking doing me at Anfield. And Keane had waited 2 years. He'd waited 2 years to do Ronnie Whelan. And you think of Ronnie Whelan, could, like you compare, right? It, you know, he never has a bad word to say about Brian Clough, because Brian Clough had his back left, right and centre all the time, you know, relentlessly so. There's a moment where Keane plays in David O'Leary's testimonial against Hungary, which is in 1993. And it's a brilliant story. Ronnie Whelan is playing in central midfield alongside Keane that day. And before the game, you know, Keane is still looked upon as like the kind of young player in the team, and kind of inexperienced. And you know, Keane's already played in numerous Wembley finals at that stage. And he's now, you know, the 5 million rated superstar. But anyway, before the game, Ronnie says to him, okay, Roy, we'll take it handy. First 5-10 minutes, just like, don't do anything rash. You know, we'll be controlled and calm and composed in centre midfield. And Keane just looks at him and goes, yeah. And the game starts and Keane bursts forward and there's an interception and he launches towards the Hungarian goal and he gets with 25 yards out and he rifles the ball in off the near post for an absolutely unbelievable goal. And like, it was one of those moments where Ronnie Whelan comes up to celebrate with him and Keane kind of gives him a look as if to say, Ronnie, you play your game and I'll play mine.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that that's, it just sums Keane up. So, you know, like, if you do him and if you wrong him and for no reason, like other than just because you want to, he's not going to be very courteous to you. In fact, he's probably going to remind you on occasion how silly you were. And he's had that for a very, very long time. And he's not going to change now. And, you know, if I was Jurgen Klopp, I would be very, very concerned. When the tide turns at Liverpool, I think Roy will be the first in line to say, can we replay this clip of me saying that they were sloppy and Jurgen having a go at me? Because he remembers everything. And, you know, when someone has a go at him, he'll file it away at the back of his head. Because again, it's the belief in himself. It's the belief in his opinion. It's the belief in what he accomplished in his career. It's the belief that drove him. It's the belief that pushed him to have the career that he had. And so when he's in a Sky Sports studio and he's saying these things about players. He believes it. Like, he believes it's not, you know, people talk about him playing up to things. There's an element of fun, but the core element of what he's saying, he believes it 110%. Again, you come back to the impatience thing from earlier. Otherwise, what's the point of being there? What's the point in just going through the motions and just making stuff up? Keane would much rather go in there and say, yeah, that's a terrible mistake by Harry Maguire. It's a terrible mistake by David De Gea. They should be sacked. You know, like, you know, if he goes into a dressing room, I'm sure he would say that, you know, with these guys back in the day, Peter Schmeichel, you know, you can definitely see the two of them having stand-up arguments with, you know, Keane saying, you think you're so great, you think you're so big and massive, like, what was that mistake about you? Absolute, you know, and, you know, insert expletive here. So he's very true to who he is. I think a lot of people make the mistake in thinking that there's a bit of performance art to it. And I guess I bring it back to that thing of the myth of Roy Keane. A lot of people would prefer to believe the myth rather than what's a little bit more authentic. And hopefully in this book, maybe that more authentic version of him is what comes across.
Owen O'Callaghan, author of Keane, The Origins, thanks very much.
Thanks, Denda.
So that is all I have time for on tonight's show. But if you do want to catch that and the extended interview and the extended chat with Colin Buig and Kieran Bradley, which we couldn't fit into tonight's show, you can find it as part of the OTB Podcast Network in the OTB Sports app or wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can find both those on the YouTube channel as well, youtube.com/offtheball. We'll be back again at the same time in the same place next week. But until then, I'll leave you to this man, Johan. Get out!